The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
Practical spirituality. Positive messages. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Discover hope and healing from the other side. Welcome to Messages of Hope with Suzanne Giesman.
Listen, they're all around you, close as a thought or a memory.
Messages of Hope.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to another week of talking about my favorite topic, the afterlife, the entire ever life, as my guides told us to talk about this ongoing existence of our life. The Daily Way message this morning was all about how we don't leave our loved ones behind. They don't leave us behind. We're moving forward with them. And my guest today can attest to that. I will tell you that just as the music started, I was tuning in to see if I felt his son, and I know this from reading his book, but I heard Sax Man loud as could be, and I know that my guest, Casey Gaunt, knows what that means. Casey, welcome to the show. We'll tell everybody who you are in just a second, but welcome.
Thank you, Suzanne. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so we're going to be talking about you and your story and your son Jimmy across the veil. And like I said, I know from the book that he played the saxophone, but it's been a week or so since I read the book. And to hear that shouted in my ear just lets me know that he's going to be inspiring us today as well.
It would be unlike him not to show up. So he's not shy, let me put it that way.
All right. Well, many of the wonderful listeners who tune in week after week have a child across the veil, but many have other loved ones, and they want to know that they're here. And I know that your story will help us to understand that you've come to know that our loved ones who passed are here. But you didn't always know that, did you?
I did not. No, not at all.
Why don't you tell us about your background?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Chicago, and you know, had a very normal, very nice childhood. I was always a great student. Finished number two in my high school class, and got a prestigious scholarship to go to the University of Southern California. Education was really important in our household. My dad, who was a big proponent of it and pretty strict, he always would tell me, and remind me what I'm in school for. And I did really well in school. That was a priority for me. Went to law school at the University of Southern California. Got my law degree and an MBA within 3 years, and then embarked on a career practicing corporate law, started in Los Angeles, and then moved down to San Diego in 1979, where our two children were born, Brittany the first, our daughter, and then Jimmy came along in 1983. The spiritual world was not in my vocabulary or within my realm of imagination until 2008. I should say that my father, who was the strongest man I knew, a highly decorated Army officer in World War II, fought in the South Pacific for 2 years, was the youngest major to achieve that rank in the South Pacific. He was awarded 2 Bronze Stars and a Legion of Merit for heroic and extraordinary meritorious service. But I know that my dad, sought a lot, did a lot, and brought back wounds that we really couldn't see. He was in some of the fiercest fighting, both in the Solomon Islands, and then he was part of the attack force on Luzon, Philippines, in 1944. So he was the strongest man I knew. He was tough. He was smart. He was just a robust, one of the first physical fitness nuts. He was jogging before that was ever popular back in the 60s. And then in 1970, right before Christmas, my dad died by suicide.
Yeah, that's just shocking to read that in your story. Yeah.
It was beyond shocking. It wasn't, I knew my dad was down. I knew that he was, battling some company financial problems, and but his death just took us all, by surprise and really floored us. Particularly my older brother and my younger sister, who was 13 at the time. I was 20 years old. My mother, who was extraordinarily strong, her mantra was, all right, we're not going to let this take us down. We're not going to talk about it. We're going to move forward, and we're going to put it behind us. And that's what we did. I'll never forget the first Christmas after. It was 1 year later, and my mom said, because my dad died on December 22nd, and my mom says, well, we know what today is, and we're not going to talk about it.
Wow. I think back to the shows we've done, like with Tom Zuba and talking about grief and how important it is to feel those feelings. And back when this happened in 1970, I'm sure that that was more of the attitude.
It was. It really was. And, my mom didn't know any better. I mean, she was being as strong as she possibly could. I know my younger sister did get some therapy. I didn't. My older brother didn't. And they suffered mightily. They were hospitalized. I mean, they were really beat up. I somehow was spared, and it was because of my first angel. 3 months after my dad died, I met Hillary Tedrow, who was the reigning Helen of Troy at USC. That's like prom queen, homecoming queen, Miss California combined, okay? I mean, it was a big deal. And I was just miraculously introduced to her, and we hit it off. We fell in love, and we were married 2.5 years later.
I want to interrupt you because I was sent a biography by my assistant, Lynette, and she said, she wrote in your biography, you wrote, Casey and Hillary, his wife and best friend of 47 years. That just warmed my heart.
She is. I mean, she just is. And but again, that was a beautiful thing, but it didn't really help me with my dad because, of course, I told Hillary about my dad, but I didn't talk about it. I didn't. When I came back to school after that Christmas vacation, quote, vacation, after my dad died, I told two fraternity brothers that he died by suicide. Everybody else, I said heart attack because I couldn't face it. Yeah. I couldn't admit it. It scared the heck out of me.
And we can just state also for so many people who have not been down the path that you and I have been, when you don't have the tools, when you don't have the awareness that there is a greater reality, that everybody is okay who passes, you just handle it however you can. And boy, that's tough.
It really is. And, I think fortunately today we're in a much better place as far as dealing with grief and helping others with grief. We still got a long way to go, but 40 years ago, it was just not as prevalent. And so, again, the way I handled my father's passing was I put him as far away from my memory as possible. I just wanted to forget him. Because that way I thought I could forget the pain and the turmoil he created for my family. Part of that process was my mom and sister, 2 weeks after my dad's death, moved from the Chicago suburb back to California to move in with her parents. So we ran out of my hometown. I abandoned all my childhood friends. I cut them off because, again, they were part of the memory, right?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, fast forward 2008, my life's great. Otherwise, you know, I've got two wonderful kids. They've both graduated from USC. My law practice is thriving. My son has spent the last 2 years. He graduated in 2006. He was a dual major in English and Spanish. And he's now pursuing his writing career in Hollywood, writing plays and screenplays. During college, he wrote 5 plays and 2 screenplays. 2 of his plays were put on by the USC Theater Department. One of which, called Leather-Clad Chaperone, he composed the music for, and the featured instrument in the play is a saxophone.
Ding, ding, ding.
Ding, 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 right? And he was so proud of that play. And that was the first play he wrote. And he had studied for 8 years from fourth grade all through high school with one of the jazz greats, a guy named Tony Ortega. And, you know, Jimmy was a phenomenal saxophone player, but writing was his passion. And so he's like, he had just signed with the talent agency, had just completed ghostwriting a screenplay for a major Hollywood director.
Can I interrupt you just a second?
Yes.
I'm going to go out on a limb here. But I am getting these sharp pains in my left arm in a place where I don't normally. Is somebody in your immediate family or are you having some challenge with your arm?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No.
It might go with Jimmy, but this definitely feels like a spirit thing.
Ooh. Well,
okay.
I hope it's not you.
No, I don't think it's me.
Okay.
The way it feels, it's not.
Okay.
It's an electrical thing.
You know what's interesting, though? I have been having a pain in my upper back for the last 2 months. So, and I think I pulled a muscle water skiing, but anyway, that I don't know.
Okay, I don't know. Okay, we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
You can get back to your story with Jimmy.
So he came home for a visit down here in Solana Beach, where we live, just north of San Diego. And he went out that night. He had dropped off for us his latest draft of his screenplay, Now's the Time. Which takes place actually during the mid-60s, and it centers around the first draft lottery that we had to send boys to Vietnam, which he thought was completely crazy, but, you know, it was true. But anyway, and he said, hey, look, you know, I'm going to be with some friends, and I may not get home. I may spend the night with somebody. So, you know, if I don't see you later, I'll, you know, see you tomorrow morning. 8 o'clock the next morning, we get a knock on the door, and there is the San Diego County Medical Examiner and a deputy sheriff to let us know that early that morning, about 5 a.m., Jimmy was walking on Del Dios Highway, which is kind of close to where we live, and he was accidentally struck and killed by an automobile. And I felt like the floor just disappeared. I also felt like something got ripped out of me. I mean, I physically felt something get ripped out of me. And I knew immediately that my life was changed forever. And Brittany, our daughter, was with us at the time because her husband was up fishing in Alaska. So we were together when we got the news. Absolutely devastated, of course. But Hillary, my wife, said the very next day when we were on a hike, she said, look, we will not let Jimmy's death take us down because that would make him so unhappy. And we are not going to make him unhappy. And that kind of set the tone.
And I love that she said that, because we can say that and say it hypothetically. If they could see us, that would make them unhappy. But it's an actuality. They do see us unhappy, and they actually don't get unhappy, but they wish us the best. And it's amazing that they truly, absolutely do not want us to be unhappy. So that she
it's
knew
so
that.
It's so true. And Jimmy came through, and we could talk about it as well, but he came through in several readings. That he always comes through in our readings that we've had with several mediums. And on a couple of occasions, he's just said how sorry he was. He made some bad decisions that night. He had too much to drink. He liked to walk when he was intoxicated, and he was at a friend's house, and he decided to, walk home. Well, he had a horrible sense of direction, just like his old man. And so he was, at the time, he was walking the wrong way, and it was on a very narrow, dark, no sidewalk street. And, you know, this young man was coming to go to work at a golf course nearby and rounded the corner. And Jimmy was, on too much on the street, and it's just the wrong place at the wrong time. A total accident.
And now you just mentioned that several mediums have brought him through, and I love just hearing everybody goes, "What? The lawyer went to a medium, and you went to several?" and so we talk about mediumship so much on this show that I think our time would be better spent, rather than talking about how the medium showed you he was around, which they did, and you detail quite beautifully in your book. I would love if we maximize our time by talking about some of the biggest wows that directly gave you the experience of Jimmy being around. And we definitely want to talk about that letter, that magical letter that you talk about in your book.
You want to start there?
If you feel that's best, go for it.
Yeah, I think so. Because it really sets the tone. I mean, because it was the door opener. It's why I was okay going to see a medium a month later. So 3 months after Jimmy died, I was in my law office, and I get a call. It's a woman named Emily Sue Buckberry, and she's calling from West Virginia. And she tells me, you may not remember me, but I was in Colwood, West Virginia with you many years ago, and you left something behind that I found, and I want to return it to you. And I go, Emily Sue Buckberry, I don't remember her at all, but I remember Colwood very well, because after I graduated from high school, I went to Colwood, West Virginia to work on a construction job for my family's business for the coal mines there. And if you've ever seen the movie October Sky or read the book Rocket Boys by Homer Hickam, that's where it takes place, in Colwood, West Virginia.
Wow.
And so Emily tells me, when you left, I went to say goodbye, but you had already taken off. But I went to your room, and outside there was a waste paper basket, and there was a letter and an envelope outside the waste paper basket. And I picked it up, and I saw it was a letter to you from your father.
Oh,
and
boy.
I read it a little bit, and it was, beautiful, but it was marked personal. And so I picked it up, and I kept it, because I thought I could get it back to you. And then she goes, one thing led to another, got in boxes, blah, blah, blah. And so now, 40 years later,
wow,
my dad wrote that letter in 1968, and I never remember getting the letter, by the way.
Ooh.
40 years later, she calls and says, I've got this letter, and I'd like to get it to you. And she said, do you want it? Oh, no. First of all, she said, do you have kids? It's a real light and breezy conversation. And I say, yes, we have Brittany. And then I tell her about Jimmy, and all the air gets sucked out of the room. She never asked me about my dad, at least on that call.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, give me your address, and I'll get this letter right off to you. I said, okay. I wasn't so sure I wanted to get something from my dad, but I said, fine. But when I hung up the phone, I was enveloped in goosebumps, head to toe. I felt like a electric wire had been put in the top of my head. I was just shaking. I was going, because I felt, I didn't know what was going on, but I felt something is going on here. Something is happening, and it's big. So the letter doesn't come the next day. It doesn't come the next day. So 5 days later, it's a Saturday, November 8th, and my family, Hillary, Brittany, her husband Ryan, and my mother, who's 88 at the time, we go down to the beach. It was a gorgeous day in Del Mar, and I had brought a little baggie of Jimmy's ashes, and Brittany and I went out on boogie boards, and we spread them, and, you know, it was very nice and very emotional.
Why did you choose that day?
I'll get to that. My mom gets tired, so I drive her home. And as I'm coming back to go to the beach, I swing by the house. I look in the mailbox, and there's the letter. And I open it up, and I start reading, and I start crying. Initially, it was two full pages. I never read this. And my dad is confessing things to me about a depression in his youth, about his fanatical religious mother, how his judgment was impaired by the war. He doesn't know if he's successful. And then he's giving me this fatherly advice, telling me you can be anything you want to be. You can do anything you want to do. You've got all sorts of talent. Go to work, blah, blah, blah. And just beautiful. And he closes with, I'll be around anytime you want me. I'll be there. Because I care more than you'll ever know. My son, all love, Dad. And you asked about the significance of that day. That Saturday, November 8th, the day the letter came. I cry every time I tell this story. That was Jimmy's 25th birthday. The letter arrived on his birthday because my dad knew that was going to be one of the toughest days of my life. And he was there for me. He was with me as he promised he would be in the letter he had written 40 years earlier.
Wow.
And I'm just going, oh, my God.
The timing of that. You know now that there are no coincidences.
Oh, no. I mean, the odds of that, it's incalculable. No. I mean, this was orchestrated. And I knew Jimmy was involved in that. I knew he needed my dad and me to start getting better, to start healing our relationship. And my psychologist told me this. I mean, I started seeing a psychologist right after, you know, six weeks after Jimmy did, because I knew I needed help. I now had to deal with my dad and Jimmy.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, look, we will never be able to start working on Jimmy until we deal with your dad. So that was the door opener. A month later was the first reading we had with Tara, the medium from Sedona. And Jimmy came through so big on that reading. Oh, my God. That was our first reading. And, I'm this corporate lawyer who had never thought about this. That would have been the last thing I ever would have done. Sure. But were it not for this door opener with my dad's letter, I probably wouldn't have done it. But
and I'm sure that they knew that and said, we got to do something in a big way to get his attention. And more they did.
Yeah. It was a big jump start for me. I needed the, I needed that jump start big time. But then, I mean, that was the first time Jimmy came through, you know, and really apologized for putting us through what he did. And he was so apologetic and, you know, wanted us to know he was okay. And he's giving us all these signs, about, you know, the fact that he's over there and he's still pushing the buttons over on this side. And it was just a healing, cleansing experience. And that on top of what I had received from my dad, it really began to just open me up.
I'm being an evidence-based medium. Anybody who's new to this show would have heard those beautiful messages of comfort that you got through the medium. And I know they're valid, but I know you also got some evidence, meaning some things that the medium said that she couldn't have known that validate those messages. Do any come to mind?
Absolutely. She asked us to give her things right when the reading started, with jewelry, coins, things like that. And so I gave her this old bulky Casio watch I was wearing. And so she's holding it, and she looks at me, and she goes, "Where's the watch Jimmy gave you?" Huh. I go, "Oh, my God, how do you know that?" 2 weeks after he died, I was going through his backpack that he left in, you know, at our house, and I found this Rolex watch. And I go, I didn't give him a Rolex watch. You know, where did he get it? We soon solved the mystery. A couple weeks later, it was given to him by a mentor that he was working with up in L.A. You know, the watch was meant for me, and Tara just picked up on that immediately. Hmm. And then she says, "You're finding pennies, aren't you?" And I go, "Yeah." And so I reach into my pocket, and I pull out, you know, 5 pennies that I had found the day before at the gym I go to, and I was finding these all over the place. The really funny one, though, is when Tara said to Brittany, because we did this reading together, we did all our readings together, and Jimmy's talking, and he's telling Brittany, "You know, I'm not watching you." And Brittany starts laughing hysterically, and she goes, "I've been having this thing about, you know, sleeping with Ryan, and I'm thinking that Jimmy could be watching us." And
so he's in his thoughts. I love
Jimmy
that.
Goes, "I'm not a pervert.
Look, we have
I'm
to go to a break. We're going to a break right now, but we'll be back. More stories and some great advice for you about how to write a beautiful condolence card. That's going to be a great tool for everybody. So everybody, come on back in 3 minutes. More with Casey Gaunt.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Messages of Hope with Suzanne Giesemann.
Well, that was a fast break. I've been sitting here chatting with our guest, Casey Gaunt. He is a former corporate attorney, now retired and doing writing to help others heal from their grief after the passing of his son and his father. Casey, in your book, you talk about several situations where you encountered others who had children pass. And in the beginning, you were unable to even talk to them. Would you address that? Because I'm sure many listening can identify with not knowing what to say or even turning and going the other way.
Yeah. It's something that so many of us who have, you know, lost those we deeply love have to deal with on a almost a daily basis. But when I was, you know, in my 40s, I had a dentist that I saw, you know, for 10, 15 years. And I heard that his 4-year-old son was playing in the backyard with a friend, and they were digging a cave in a hillside behind their house, and the cave collapsed, and the 4-year-old boy suffocated. Mm. And so what did I do? I went and found a new dentist.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't talk to him. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. Something similar happened just before Jimmy died. Good friends of ours, pretty good friends of ours, their 18-year-old son died of an accidental drug overdose his freshman year at USC. And so we're in like June of 2008. And I see Gary, the dad, out on Torrey Pines South Golf Course, where they were holding the U.S. Open Championship. I see Gary, and I just turn around and walk away. I can't talk to him. I don't know what to say. You know, Hillary experienced the same things when she would go to a grocery store, and she'd see friends, And I know, Suzanne, this was in your book, too, when you moms were talking about the very same thing. Hillary would see somebody she knew, and that person would just turn around and pretend she didn't see Hillary. And Hillary would
It hurts. It hurts for those of us on the receiving end of that. But you can also put yourself in the shoes of other people. And the thing is, it comes from ignorance, not knowing.
Right. Yeah. And so one of the things that I learned, and some people, as you know, are extraordinarily surprising. I mean, they come right up to you and they just say, I'm so sorry. You know, what can I do? Or, you know, they bring it up. But a lot don't. It is ignorance, and they think they're going to be pulling the scab off the wound, and they're going to hurt me. So one of the things that I learned fairly early on was if I saw somebody, like a friend or a colleague, who I hadn't seen since Jimmy died, I brought it up. I brought Jimmy up. And as soon as I opened that door, I had to back up because they rushed through so fast, they couldn't wait to talk and, you know, and say what was bottled up inside them. You know, they would say, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say, but, you know, I'm so sorry. And so that's one thing that we, you know, who have suffered this kind of loss, that's one thing we can do to help others, help our colleagues and our friends, help start the conversation, give them permission to grieve with you. And I call that going halfway, you know, just open the door.
Very nice. And it's healing for you as well to talk about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's particularly bad with the dads and the guys. You know, we're supposed to stiff upper lip, soldier on, get through it, don't show any chink in the armor. And so we're kind of wired that way. Mm-hmm. But the wiring is pretty flimsy, and once, you know, you do open the door for them and start the conversation, it's very healing. It's beautiful, just absolutely beautiful.
Perfect. I hope we do get to how to write a beautiful condolence card. If we don't get to that, the folks can find that on your website, correct?
Yes. It's called... Okay. How to write a beautiful condolence card to someone who has lost a child. And then there's a companion post, writing a condolence card to someone who has lost a loved one to suicide.
Oh, very helpful. So we may get to that, but I would like to focus for a few minutes on some more of the beautiful, magical, it's not magic at all, it's just reality signs from Jimmy. Like something happened at a wedding.
Yes. So Jimmy's best friend, since he was a baby, John, was getting married, and this is 2 years ago. And John called me up, and he asked me, he said, you know, would you be my best man? Huh. He said, I would have asked Jimmy, since he's always been like a little brother to me, but obviously he can't do it, and I would love to have you. And I said, I'd be honored to do it. But I said, John, you know, if I'm standing there as your best man, Jimmy's going to be front and center at your wedding. And he goes, that's why I'm asking you. So
that is just so awesome. Look how far you've come, right?
But, you know, so now, you know, it's like a couple weeks before the wedding, and I got to come up with my best man speech, right? So, and it's got to be good. And I'm thinking, you know, what would Jimmy say? And Hillary, and I'm asking her for help, and I'm asking Brittany for help. I'm asking Jimmy for help. So Hillary, 2 weeks before the wedding, goes into a file cabinet that she hasn't been into in years, because that file cabinet's like Superman kryptonite for her. It contains all of this stuff that's Jimmy, you know, his report cards, his papers, his cards he wrote to her. But she got a shove, she said. It was not a message. It wasn't a push. It was a shove from Jimmy telling her to go in there. So she starts going through, and she's looking through things, and she finds this letter, another letter. It was a
Hillary
recommendation letter that Jimmy wrote for John in 2001 as part of John's application to get into Brown University. And it was filled of everything we wanted to say. Jimmy's talking about how he's always looked up to John. You've always been my big brother. You've helped me out of jams. You know, you were such a leader, a scholar, blah. I mean, it was beautiful. So I said, thank you, Jimmy. And Brittany.
And I just have to stop there a second, Casey, just so everybody understands, that's not luck. That is your son still right here, part of your life. You asked him for help. And the best part is Hillary got that shove and acted on it. That's what it
takes.
No question.
I mean, it was so obvious, so clear to all of us that he said, hey, I'm right here, you know, and I'm going to be involved in this. You know, Kay, Dad, yeah, you're standing in my shoes, but I'm the best man, not you. So, so Brittany read that that message or the letter as part of the toast that I gave. And after, you know, the speeches and everything, and we were at the bar, a guy comes up to me, and he's a young guy, you know, early 30s, tall, good-looking guy. And he said, Mr. Gaunt, my name is Henry Armstrong, and I was so moved by, you know, your words on multiple levels. Hillary, by this time, comes up to my side, and I said, Hillary, this is Henry Armstrong. Hillary looks at him. Tears are erupting from her eyes. She said, the Henry Armstrong? Can I give you a hug? And they hug like there's no tomorrow. And then it dawned on me. Henry Armstrong was the last guy that Jimmy saw alive.
Oh, my.
That's the house he stayed in after they had partied all night. And that's the house he left to try and walk. And we had not heard from Henry 9 years after Jimmy's death. We had not heard from Henry, and we had not reached out to Henry. And we spent a lot of time talking with Henry that night, and he was carrying a lot of guilt, a lot of what-ifs, you know, what could I have done? And so it dawned on us right then, well, yeah, Jimmy was supposed to give this toast, but he was also setting this up so we could meet and heal and bring healing to Henry, who'd been suffering for so long. And then that whole night, other friends of Jimmy came up to me and just unloaded with grief and emotion and love for Jimmy, guys we'd never heard from, okay? Mm-hmm. Jimmy orchestrated the whole darn thing.
There's no
and
doubt.
That's kind of what he does. He's a playwright, and he orchestrates these things with multiple characters and subplots and layers of purpose. That just blow us away.
Wow. That's fantastic. Now, you talk about how Jimmy's helping heal people here, but I believe you have some examples, if you'd share one, of how we can heal those across the veil, and you learned that through your connection with Jimmy.
I did. And it really started with, as I said, the letter that I got from my dad. And before that, I, as far as I was concerned, my relationship with my dad was completely broken. But that door opened, and walls that I had erected to keep my dad away from me and my memory began to come down. And so I did a number of things. I wrote a very extensive story about my dad, particularly his early years. His heroic achievements during World War II, put that up on our website. I wrote letters to my dad, forgiving him, telling him how much I loved him. And I shared all this, including the story of the letter, with my family and extended family and friends. And we began to talk about my dad like we'd never done before. And we brought my dad into the light, you know, instead of keeping him in this dark basement.
Yeah.
And I started to have really good dreams about my dad. Before my dad, the dreams I had about my dad were creepy. Like he would just show up at our house in Chicago and wouldn't say a word. He would just be working on something, then he'd disappear. But now my dreams, I'm talking to him, I'm hugging him, we're laughing, he's looking good. And then a year and a half ago, I got an email from a rabbi in New York who had just learned that our son Jimmy had died. She met Jimmy one time in Poland at a retreat that my brother, who's a Zen Buddhist master teacher, he holds on an annual basis these retreats to Auschwitz-Birkenau, the death camps, to bear witness to horrible things that man continues to do to man. And that's where the rabbi met Jimmy. And she had also read the story of the letter from my dad. And mm-hmm. she had this observation. She said, tragic death can lead to healing and mending relationships across lifetimes and generations. And she said, example number one, your son, your father, and you. And I said, yeah, you know, I think I am helping my dad, but how do I know? And then in February of this year, I had a reading with Chris Lynn. She's also known as the Blue Jean Mystic, which I was telling Suzanne at the break. Chris studied under Suzanne and thinks very highly of her. And this was the first mediumship reading I'd had with Chris. And after Jimmy came through and my grandmother, my dad came through. And this is the first time my dad's ever come through in a reading. And Chris is saying, I have a father figure here, and he's nodding his head, and he's just so grateful, so grateful. And I just know instantaneously it's my dad. I start crying. Chris says, he is so grateful because you helped him heal. You helped him heal over there. And Chris then says, I had no idea we could do that, that we can help them. I always thought that they have their helpers over there. We don't, you know, need to help them. But your dad's showing me that what we do here is helping them over there. And Absolutely. He went on to say, he said, I've got my heart back. I have my heart back. And I know mm-hmm. how hard my choice was for you, his suicide. But I'm so grateful that you didn't abandon me.
Wow. You know, Casey, the class I teach in person is called Serving Spirit, and it's one of the first things I tell people, my students, is that we serve those who no longer have a voice. We give them a chance to say, I'm sorry, yeah. and to ask for forgiveness. So absolutely, it goes both ways, and it's just yeah. beautiful validation you got of the efforts that you made and how they helped your dad. So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, sure. No, it was so gratifying for me because, you know, I had this sense that I was helping him, but to have him confirm it like he did.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Yeah. And you mentioned dreams there and your dreams being a little bit upsetting at a time and then changing. But Jimmy has come through dreams, I understand.
He has. The one in particular, this was about a year and a half after he died. And he came through in a dream for Brittany. And Brittany described it. Jimmy was dressed up in his Little League uniform, probably 10 or 11 years old. And he tells her, he says, Britt, you're pregnant. And it's a boy.
And
Brittany wakes up. She bolts out of bed. They had been trying. And so she takes her, you know, home pregnancy test, and sure enough, she's pregnant. And 4 months later, we were all together for her sonogram, and the nurse is, you know, moving the stick around, and she goes, well, you ready? It's a boy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, Jimmy's also come through to his nephews. Wyatt is our oldest grandson, but when he was like 3 or 4 years old, Wyatt would come into his mom's room, Brittany's room, and said, Mom, can I sleep with you? And Brittany would go, well, sure, what's going on? He finally admitted, he said, well, there's a man that comes into my room, and he stands by my bed, and he just smiles. And Brittany said, well, does he say anything? No, he just smiles. Hmm. And Brittany said, well, do you know who it is? And Wyatt says, it's this guy. And she points at a picture of Jimmy.
I love these stories. I can never hear them too often.
I know.
That's so affirming.
You know, he's looking after his nephews as he continues to look after all of us and check in and just make sure that we're okay, and letting us know that he's okay and doing his thing. And he always, when he comes to a reading, he always is so complimentary of me. And he said, "Dad, I'm just so proud of you, you know, all that you're doing, all that you're writing, you know, and helping these other parents." This is kind of interesting. In the reading with Chris Lynn, Jimmy came through and he showed Chris a microphone. And he was saying, "You got to do more. You got to get out there more. You got to talk to more people." So Jimmy orchestrated this conversation we're having right now, Suzanne.
Fantastic. That's great. Now, speaking of talking to people, you know, we talked in the first half hour that at first you couldn't talk to others who had a loved one pass to the other side. But later on in your book, you talk about how actually you gathered together with a group of people in the same situation, and you call the group the fraternity, your brothers.
Yes. Yeah, my brothers-in-law. So in 2013, and this is kind of one of the points that I make in the book, and it'll be a featured point in the book I'm working on right now, and that is, you know, we hope that those of us, you know, in this situation, we hope we get to a point where we can begin to help others. You know, that's part of the evolution. Some it happens, you know, early, some a little later, but it was, for me, it was 5 years where I really felt I could begin to help others, sit across from, you know, parents and companion them and not only share stories, but also give some, you know, advice and things like that. So we started, I started with two other dads, the fraternity in San Diego, we've grown to over 25, and we meet regularly, usually every 2 or 3 months. And this is the opportunity for, you know, the dads to share stories, talk about their kids, and even more important, share these stories of these incredible experiences and messages that they're getting from their kids that they can't share with anybody else because, you know, others don't get it, or they'll think I'm crazy or what have you. And so it's just a wonderful door opener and way for dads to really talk about the things that, you know, they just can't talk with anybody else about. And
what a difference from the decades of not talking about your dad's passing, just shutting the door, shutting it down. And this is why groups like Helping Parents Heal, those of you who are listening that are saying, well, how do I get a fraternity or a group like that? HelpingParentsHeal.org is a beautiful, beautiful resource for that kind of gathering. And they meet online if there's no group near you. What is the tribe? I understand that's a similar group.
Yeah, it's similar. So, when after we started the website in 2011 and started the fraternity, there were a group of parents and others that I was communicating with regularly, sharing stories, sharing things that I had found or people had sent to me. And so in addition to the website, I decided to start what I call the tribe. And it's a little more intimate than the website, so I'll send out stories. I sent out one recently about a very amazing connection involving a good friend of mine who just died of pancreatic cancer a month ago. And then this, you know, it's an opportunity. It's almost like a blog, but it's an opportunity for people to comment and reach back. And we've got about 130 people in the tribe.
Wow.
And it's really people that have, you know, as we learn, you know, through our grief and our healing process, we have to kind of build a tribe. Because those that we thought were always there for us, they may not be there anymore. And you also want to, you know, we also find ourselves being connected and meeting other people in similar circumstances that we can help one another. And that's the tribe. And I try and send out something at least once a week to stay in touch with them. And I get some beautiful things from the tribe members to share as well.
That's lovely. And your website, you've mentioned it several times, writemesomethingbeautiful.com. I have a feeling you do that in conjunction with Jimmy, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in fact, those words were the last words he spoke to his good friend Eric when they were having dinner at a Mexican restaurant. And Eric was a budding writer, and Jimmy just said, "Hey, Eric, write me something beautiful and send it to me."
Oh, man.
And Eric, when he got up in front of the 1,000 people at Jimmy's memorial service, Eric said, "You know, Jimmy, I'm sorry I didn't get to write you something beautiful before you passed, but I hope what I read today you'll accept in lieu of that." And it was extraordinary. Oh, my God. So that's where the website title came from.
I love it. And you co-wrote your book with you, the one, Suffering is the Only Honest Work. The title feels a little bit of a downer, but it's something that Jimmy wrote. So you're honoring him with that, correct?
I am. It's after he ran the 2007 Los Angeles Marathon, he wrote a poem, and that's the title of the poem. And it's a very powerful poem. He's writing about just the agony, the challenges of running a marathon, finishing a marathon, hitting a wall, doubt is a bad idea.
It sounds like life.
It is. And then he finishes the poem with this trail, or this death is not even a trailhead in the endless loop through ourselves. And when my body is lying flat in the tall grass, the rest of me is running up the hill. Mm. So he was very Buddhist, too. But what Jimmy is saying is, hey, look, this isn't my first ride. I'm coming back. We all come back. We all are learning. And it's work. You know, it's work. And that suffering is just part of life. There's also joy, there's happiness, there's love, but suffering's part of it.
That's true.
How we learn.
Yeah. Yeah. Sigh. However, I love in your book, if we have just a minute to go here, you write, so often we dismiss the interconnectedness of humanity, and we have these opportunities and moments at our fingertips to connect with others. You and I have both had children pass suddenly, unexpectedly, and, you know, with these, you think, you know, did we say everything we wanted to say? Could you just say something for everybody listening as we wrap this up about the interconnectedness and any words of advice?
We're one. There is no this side or the other side. I think the veil is really, there is no veil. It's really our inability to see. Our brains aren't big enough. Our consciousness isn't big enough. But the fact is that when we talk about our loved one or to a loved one, they hear us. When they talk, you know, they're reaching through to us. They are right here. And
we, Jim, Casey, that is the most perfect way. And unfortunately, we're out of time. But that, what you just said, it's our inability to see, but just trust that they're here. And you've helped us to do that today. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Suzanne. Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate having the opportunity.
Thank you for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Hello, I'm Dr. Stephen Farber, and I am an author, teacher, psychotherapist, and shamanic practitioner. On my podcast, Healing for Your Soul, I welcome some amazing guests and introduce you to some healing techniques like earth magic, working with nature and animals, and really getting to the heart of what is keeping you stuck. I want to help you deepen your spirituality and let go of blocks that are holding you back. Let me help you in this journey called life. Part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network, subscribe and follow wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode.